Well, let's talk about book banning in America. I really enjoyed your book. It's almost written like a young adult book with the anecdotal beginnings and so forth. It doesn't sell at a young adult price, though, $21.95.
What I wanted to do was to write a story. That's what I set out to do, the story of book banning, instead of some kind of journalistic facts-only type of thing. And I thought that one way to do a story would be to try to put as many anecdotes, as much dramatic material in there as I could. If you liked it in that fashion, I'm pleased.
It does read like a story.
Thank you.
Obviously, it builds, and the reader, at least this reader, found myself at the end of every chapter, if you call them chapters, I guess, with a sense of indignity and anger. I think that's what you were trying to do.
Yes, you read me very well. That's exactly what I was trying to do. The point of censorship is that when you get to the area where things are no longer being published or stopped from publication, there should be indignity because none of us should be in a position to have to suffer that kind of insult.
Well, we know there are isolated cases of book banning and censorship, but very isolated. We actually have a very free press and literary climate today, don't we?
I wish I could agree with that, but I think that the decade of the 1980s has shown us that we've gone through a pretty conservative era politically, and history has taught us that when the political climate is conservative, book banning and censorship will follow right along. For example, back in the 1950s, during the McCarthy era, we had a spurt of book banning, and you remember the blacklisting in the film industry, for example. And then during the 60s and 70s, when things became more liberal, when the idea of open speech and free speech was a lot more supportive than it has been lately, almost everything could be published. Now, in the 80s, you suffered from book banning because of the political climate as much as anything else.
Who are the people who seek to ban books?
They come in all walks of life. They come from all sections of the country. They come from all economic groups, even all political persuasions, left as well as right. They are in groups and they are individuals. But I think from a standpoint of just sheer power, the groups represent the major source of concern for me. You're talking about groups of people in some cases. There's one women's group, for example, that's got over 500,000 members across the country. And among other things, book banning is not their only interest, but certainly they come out strongly against the publication of certain books, the dissemination of certain books when they feel it's in their interest.
So who are the people, though? Are we talking about political conservatives and the religious right wing?
Not only, no. Certainly that's the area where people mostly think they come from, but you've got a certain group of the feminists who are against pornography, who feel that pornography puts women into a position of having their civil rights violated, and the only way to prevent that from going forward is to do away with all books dealing with pornography. Now, while we may find that disagreeable, once we start, where do we stop? So there's a left side of the equation as well as the right side of the equation. The story of Huckleberry Finn, for example, where in the 1880s, when it was first published, it was banned as a earthy, disagreeable novel by the conservatives. 100 years later now, people are finding it racist, and so they're banning it for that purpose.
Yeah, you mentioned in the book efforts by some feminists led by, what's her name,
Andrea Dworkin and Catherine McKinnon, who's an attorney.
But they've pretty well been repudiated even by members of feminist organizations, haven't they?
I can't speak for all the feminist organizations, but I do know that there are supporters that they still have because they almost were able to achieve the passage of legislation in Indianapolis, Indiana, and Minneapolis, Minnesota in the middle 1980s to get their views regarding pornography passed as legislation. It came very close.
Yeah, that was terrible. This book insults me, or as a woman, it insults me, and mm-hmm. I don't like it, and I don't want it read by anybody. That's ridiculous.
Well, I think, you know, the cure becomes worse than disease in a situation like that, and that's one of the big dangers of engaging in censorship to try to right a wrong. It's easy to cut off a person's right to read because you can disagree with what the object of the book may be, but in doing that, you remove that book from anybody else's consideration as well, and you never know where to stop once you start.
And the other, you mentioned Huckleberry Finn, there are some black groups seeking to promote their integrity as a race, I guess.
I think that's pretty good.
I assume that Huckleberry Finn is somewhat insulting, although Jim one of the lead characters in Huckleberry Finn is kind of like an Uncle Tom, but he's also very shrewd, as I recall. I've been years since I've read it, but he observes things and is very much aware.
Yes, he's a very observant and a very dignified man in his own way, but the speech that Mark Twain puts into his mouth and the way he is treated by others in the book, calling him boy, for example, when he's a grown man, is insulting to anyone who happens to be black, I think. The question becomes, is Huckleberry Finn, has it been around long enough to reach the stage of classic, and therefore the classic somewhat immune from any kind of criticism regarding censorship? That's a question I really don't know the answer to, but I think that censorship as a rule is something we shouldn't indulge in, so I would bend toward the idea that all classics should be allowed to remain on the shelves for whatever reason and whoever they might insult.
And in chapter after chapter in your book, the people who seek to ban books seem to be these fundamentalist Christians.
Well, if that's the impression I gave, I'm sorry, because it isn't so. I know, for example, I have a chapter on the government here and on the government agencies, such as the CIA, particularly the CIA, in fact, where book banning has been indulged in for national security purposes. Now, the people at the CIA, at the FBI, the NSA, and some of the other organizations certainly can't be called religious fundamentalists, but they have engaged in book banning to a distinctive level over the years, over the last 20 years, for example. I'll give you one idea that the CIA in 1989, through its Publications Review Board, which requires all former CIA employees to submit manuscripts for approval or changing, if it deals with matters that they learned while they were on CIA status, 18,000 pages were reviewed in 1989 by the CIA Publications Review Board. That's over 300 manuscripts. That's just one idea of the activity in this area by the government.
Yeah, the CIA does it in the name of national security.
Yeah.
Well, it seems rather ridiculous, as you point out, some of the stupid things the CIA has done, where the information that has been public knowledge, after the fact, the CIA decides
to restrict it. That's the problem with censorship. Your idea of censorship, or my idea of censorship, or anyone else's, will differ because it's a personal judgment. What we think might be or might not be national security can't be duplicated by two or three people sitting around a table. We'll all have our own biases. And so once we start, we're going to probably throw the baby out with the bathwater. And I think it's better not to start, even though it may cause some difficulty somewhere down the line for people.
Of course, on these local school boards, where you have some very specific examples, the efforts to ban books are so crude.
Mm-hmm.
Their reason is so skewered. I'm against this because it uses the name of the Lord offensively to me, and therefore you can't read it. It's crude efforts to, I mean, it's like primitives. They're like primitives. I mean, at least the CIA has the power of the government and the courts and the law behind them, mm-hmm. and the other people seem to act out of pure emotion.
Well, I think the emotion is very real. I don't minimize the fact people really feel this way. I think there's a fear factor at work here. At least the psychologists that I talked to in connection with this book made that clear to me, that people genuinely fear the written word and genuinely fear a book that comes out that's on the shelves that they consider to be offensive to their religious beliefs or whatever other things they might hold important. But the thing to also be concerned with is that how this fear is translated, that if a parent comes into a school board and says, I think a book should be taken off the shelves because I believe it's offensive to whatever beliefs I hold dear, they're making a judgment not only for themselves and their own children, but for other people's children as well. And I find that not to be something I'd want to support. It's okay if you as a parent want to say to your own children, I don't want you to read that. Or even to tell a school, I don't want my child to read that book. But censorship comes into the picture when they want to censor the book for other people's children as well, because they fear it's too much of a challenge or too much of a danger. I think that goes beyond the line.
Of course, there is such a thing in the schools as an age-appropriate book, isn't there?
I think many schools have certain shelves where at a certain age books would be available to the students, and under that age they would not be available, yeah. But school boards make these judgments based on their own individual needs and wants, and what it does is, in a very modified way, it creates other censorship problems. Once you start saying what books should be read and what books shouldn't be read by certain children, as an institutional thing, as a general rule, then you're creating censorship problems on a general nature that I think will end up causing a lot more problems because it has to be affected over a wide area.
Mr. Noble, you mentioned a moment ago that you interviewed some psychologists with regard to writing this book. Can you give me a kind of a profile of one who would seek to bar others from reading a certain book?
Well, apparently, people who engage or who feel some kind of a concern or danger out of books are those who have a deep feeling that the devil, in some fashion, is in the written word. That the devil is there, and he or she is there, always ready to strike when someone is reading a book that's offensive. That we have to get rid of that devil, out of those words, out of that philosophy, and the only way to do it is to remove the book from the shelves. Now, historically, that feeling went back into the 15th, 16th, and 17th centuries when books were banned. On the continent of Europe, for example, they used to burn heretics at the stake and their books along with them if they did any writing. And in this country, we've had book burnings ever since 1650, when the first book was burned in America in the Boston marketplace. So over 300 years, we've had book burnings in the U.S. And in fact, just 2 weeks ago in my native Vermont, where I live, we had a book burning just 20 miles from my house.
Hope it wasn't your book.
No. As Mark Twain said when they first banned Huckleberry Finn, he wrote to his cousin and he said, "Dear Charlie, they've just banned Huckleberry Finn in the Concord, Massachusetts library. That means we'll sell 25,000 more copies." It still holds true. No, they didn't burn my book in Vermont, but they burned a number of other books, including Tolkien's book and in The Wizard of Oz. And surprisingly enough, they burned Beethoven's records.
What was this, a local school?
No, this was a church group that was looking to expiate some form of sin and the devil from the locality. They burned Beethoven's records because he apparently cursed God on his deathbed.
Well, that's all right. I mean, they can do that. Mm-hmm. I mean, anybody can start a bonfire and throw the books he hates on it, right? I mean, but that's not really censorship or banning, is it?
Well, if a book is already published and a book is then thrown on the bonfire and it disappears in flame and smoke, I consider it censorship. It's taking a book out of circulation for a reason.
Yeah, but if you bought that book, you can give it as a gift, you can destroy it, leave it in the attic, donate it to the library, burn it, you can do anything you want. You shelled out the money for it.
Well, certainly.
You're not going to tell me I can't do what I want to with book banning in America.
I hope you show that to all your friends and neighbors. But truly, no, I think a private group, if they decide among themselves to burn a book, they're within their rights under the U.S. Constitution to do that, even under the First Amendment. I've got no problem with that. I would hope they wouldn't, but because I think all books should be disseminated for the knowledge they contain, but I can't prevent that from happening.
Are there any books in the last 25 years or so that stand out as particular targets?
Yeah, certainly The Catcher in the Rye. Year after year after year, The Catcher in the Rye comes up as an issue in various school districts for banning. In fact, just last year in California, The Catcher in the Rye was banned in a small community. Another book.
There's one scene in there in which Holden Caulfield has an association with a prostitute in a hotel room.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably the one.
That's the one that seems to stand out more than anything else. But then, of course, he also, just his general coming of age reflections can create problems for some readers, because he does get a little bit earthy in the way he thinks about himself and some of the girls he wants to go out with and some of the ways he treats his fellow, or thinks of his fellow schoolmates. Another book, or a series of books, that always seem to come up for banning are the Judy Blume, whatever books Judy Blume has written. They seem to come up in school district after school district, and of course Judy Blume has been supported and in fact has become renowned for the way she has treated adolescent problems from a female perspective, particularly over the years. And I support her completely in doing that, but by being so open about the concerns and the activities of the adolescent girl particularly, she has caused some problems for people who want to read her books, and they've gone out to try to ban them. I'm not talking about one book now, I'm talking about a whole series of them, five or six.
Yeah, whenever there's a Judy Blume book, there's a red flag that is that she deals with issues that are very important to children.
Yes, indeed.
And you're talking about masturbation, menstruation,
mm-hmm.
all sorts of things that are real issues to
even
people as they grow up.
Even teenage sex.
What other books seem to stand out?
Well, one that I constantly shake my head at, because this happened in 1987 in Alaska, the American Heritage Dictionary was banned. And they banned the American Heritage Dictionary up there because certain words that we think of as nouns, like bed and balls, nut, were given secondary meanings. The word bed was, of course, turned into a verb and defined that way in the dictionary. So it became something to bed someone. And that was objected to in Alaska, and the dictionary was removed from the shelves up there.
So we can remove all the dictionaries of slang, you know, and mm-hmm. that would eliminate the problem, right?
Well, the Dictionary of American Slang itself was banned. So, yes, I mean, remove all... But, you see, the American Heritage Dictionary was not considered slang. They weren't using these things in a slang way. They come to the decision that changing or adding a meaning to certain words was no longer slang, but part of our language, part of our formal language.
Are there any heroes who stand out in your book who have fought against book banning?
Oh, yeah. With every negative reaction, every negative activity that happens with book banning, there are always people who are going to stand up for it. A person I write about in the book is a man named Gene Lanier, who's a librarian in North Carolina, and a fascinating man. In the 1950s, he was with the counterintelligence service in the Army over in Germany, and his job was to look for German war criminals or Germans who were hiding under assumed names who still had to answer for their deeds during the war. And he was invited into various German homes he went into German homes to find some of these people, and he got friendly with some of the German families whose homes he was in. And as he got friendlier with them, he discovered that they began talking about the things that Hitler and Germany went on in Germany in the 1930s and 40s, and the people, one after another, one family after another, would talk about how they didn't realize how many rights they were giving up in the 30s and 40s to achieve stability in their lives, particularly the right to speak freely and to write freely. And these we've heard about these tremendous bonfires of books that the Nazis promoted in the 30s, where 20,000 or more books would be burned at one time. And Gene Lanier was very impressed by these stories that these German families gave to him. He came back to the United States, pursuing his library career, becoming more and more convinced that our First Amendment is so important that we simply cannot afford to take it for granted in any form. And over the years, he became what he called himself a First Amendment purist. He said the First Amendment reads, Congress shall pass no law restricting freedom of speech or expression. And he said that means no law. If it's Congress, it means any state, it means any school district, it means any governmental organization. And in pursuit of his view, he has traveled all over the country talking about his feelings regarding the First Amendment. And he has suffered some severe criticism on the part of conservative groups. They boycott, they picket his place of where he works. He has been called a pornographer because he won the Hugh Hefner First Amendment Award some years ago. Conservative groups who called him a pornographer considered him to be someone, if he took the Hugh Hefner Award, Playboy has to be pornography, they claimed, therefore he's a pornographer. Of course, there's no connection between the two, but nevertheless, he suffered that on and on through the years. And he spends many of his hours each year traveling all around the United States trying to get his message out that our First Amendment is too important to take for granted. We have to support it, even in the face of things we may disagree with.
There are a few others, too.
Oh, sure. H.L. Mencken, in the 1920s, he went up to Boston because his magazine, The American Mercury, was being challenged in Boston by the powers in Boston who liked to ban books. And Mencken went into the Boston Common and firmly supported an article concerning hat rack that he had personally approved for publication. The article concerned the activities of a prostitute in St. Louis who claimed that she would do her work on Sunday evenings after she had gone to church in the morning and worshiped with many of the men who came to see her in the evening. And the story caused so much grief in Boston that they wanted to ban Mencken's magazine. He went up and he personally sold a copy in the middle of the Boston Common to a policeman, and he was then arrested. And this became the very famous hat rack case, which, incidentally, Mencken and the American Mercury finally won.
Another hero in your book, you don't go into detail, but it's Barney Rossett, who all by himself championed Lady Chatterley's Lover.
Yes, he did. And in talking with Barney, he indicated he would do it again and again and again if he had an opportunity. He said that, in my view anyway, Barney Rossett is instrumental in getting many of the classics into this country in the 60s that we would not have them today if it wasn't for Barney Rossett, who was willing to take the chance to and fight the government and fight the censors to try to achieve the publication of these books in the U.S. There was one available in Europe, but through the 20s, 30s, and 40s, these books were banned, such as Lady Chatterley's Lover, the Henry Miller books, Tropic of Cancer, Tropic of Capricorn, and some others. Barney Rossett was willing to publish these books in the U.S., take the litigation heat, go through all the way up to the Supreme Court to get these books published here. And as I said, today he said he would do the same thing over and over again. He considers it that important.
There was a time, however, I think the American public accepted censorship. I remember as a kid when the movies that would be approved by the censorship or whatever mm-hmm. they called it. Yeah. The same thing in Maryland and other places where I've lived. And nobody seemed to mind. There were always mavericks who challenged it, who tried to get movies past this board. Or not so much books, but I think Americans just said, well, we need someone to guide us, and so we'll accept it.
Well, here again, I think partially, anyway, the political climate may have been responsible for that. I remember going back into the 50s now, in the early 60s, when there was a more conservative outlook out there, and we kind of expected that whatever people said to us we should do, we will do. But gradually through this century, as things have gotten along, we've gotten more and more open in what we want to have, and the 60s showed us that there was so much out there that we needed to read, that we should read, that wasn't being granted to us, things that were being denied to us, that were interesting, were educational as well as exciting, that we should read them. I think that what we suffered from, if I can use that word, certainly what we had to deal with 20, 30, 40 years ago in terms of what we could read, these things were a product of the political climate and the fact that we were coming out of a Victorian era where things were very much controlled in our society. We've made a break from that, but it's only been in the last 25 years that we can really say that's occurred.
What is your background, Mr. Noble?
Well, I was a lawyer for some years, not too many years, but long enough to know that it was never going to fulfill me for the rest of my life. So I left that about 20 years ago, and I've been writing ever since.
I see you worked in Lancaster.
Yeah, I was in the Model Cities program there. I was also working as a lawyer there. Very pretty city, by the way, Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Yeah, I used to work at a radio station adjoining Lancaster, York.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Many years ago. And some of the books, tell me about some of your other books.
Well, I've written several books for writers, books on writing. One book that has a kind of a catchy title that people keep chuckling about is called Shut Up, He Explained. It's a book about writing dialogue, which is done quite well for itself, and I'm pleased with its results. And then I've also written books about the practice of psychiatry, which was really an investigative look at why psychiatrists do their work and how they do it, whether we should give them as much support as we do. Then a book about privacy called The Private Me, which is a book about the need for our internal privacy. Another book about step-family relationships, which came out of my own personal experiences. I co-authored that with my late wife, and we both had step-family experiences with each other's children, and that became How to Live with Other People's Children. And an earlier book than that was a book on the custody problem called The Custody Trap.
Well, William Noble, to kind of wrap things up, do you have any advice, any guidelines that you can give us to protect ourselves from those who would ban our books?
Well, I think there are two things. I think, first of all, we have to understand our First Amendment is crucial to our way of life. We are the only industrialized city only industrialized country in this world that has a First Amendment. England doesn't have one, France, Germany, Spain, none of them have a First Amendment. We can easily take it for granted. We can assume that our right to free speech and free expression is something we've always had and always will have. But no, we've got to keep fighting for it, and we've got to keep protecting it. Second thing I think I'd like to leave you with is the fact that censorship is a pervasive thing throughout our society. It's been with us for 300 and some odd years. It isn't going to leave us. So what we have to do with censorship is to always face it down whenever we see it, recognize it as something that's part of our society. There will always be people who want to ban books, always be people who want to censor books. And we have to understand that, and we have to try to keep that as an important antagonist throughout our days in this democracy, or we're going to lose it.
Well, your book is certainly a timely book and a very important one, especially in light of the circus in Cincinnati.
Yeah.
It's absolutely incredible to single out five or seven photographs, whatever it is, out of a huge exhibit,
mm-hmm.
and there and call this late artist pornographer. It's mind-boggling.
Just think what the consequences could be if that decision went against the museum and the museum director. Seven photographs are considered to be pornographic out of 175 or 200. Maybe the next time around, only need three photographs to be considered pornographic. And then finally one out of a whole series. And then where are you?
That's the same thing with books.
Well, the books, same thing, sure.
Take out one line. Here's one line that offends me, and then ban the whole thing.
That's the way it used to be 100 years ago, you know. Obscenity was considered to exist if just a paragraph appeared in an entire book. The first book ever banned in the U.S. for obscenity by a court was 1821, was The Memoirs of Fanny Hill. And the people were so concerned about that book in 1821, up in Massachusetts, of course, this is where these things seem to start, that book was banned on the court, and the indictment that read that came out against the bookseller for selling that book didn't contain either the title of the book or anything from the book, so that the defendant could be given word as to what it was he had actually violated. They were that concerned.
That's reminiscent of the hat rack case,
yeah,
in Boston, where the judge brought the attorneys up to the bench and they whispered, mm-hmm, the audience wouldn't be offended by the testimony.
Exactly, same kind of thing. I mean, it's been quite a history we've had with obscenity and with book banning in this country.
Well, again, an important and timely book, William Noble. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Don.